This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. Search To Die For in your podcast app to follow the show.
In early 1935, Jerome, an insurance salesman, was driving his regular route from Colorado to Kansas City. He spent a lot of time on the road making sales calls. It was a lonely profession.
When he noticed a young couple hitchhiking near the Kansas border, he saw an opportunity for companionship on his long journey. He pulled over and they hopped in the car. The three of them settled into a friendly conversation as they crossed the flat farmland of the plains.
All was well until they reached the outskirts of Ulysses, Kansas. It was nighttime when the wind started to rise.
Dust blasted the body panels of the car, and wind shook the whole chassis. Soon, Jerome couldn't see the road ahead and had to stop the car.
Jerome's young passengers were scared. They wanted to find shelter, but Jerome warned them that they would get lost in the dust storm raging outside.
Even worse, the car itself was filling with dust. It was impossible to keep it out, even as they stuffed handkerchiefs and ties around the edges of the doors and windows. They were choking on the black dirt that filled the air.
The young woman was frantic. She tried to rush outside, and her husband held her back as she clawed for the door. She shouted that it felt like she was suffocating.
Jerome knew there was nowhere to go. If they went outside, they would stumble through the blinding dust until they collapsed. They had to stay overnight in the car, or the black blizzard would kill them. They were trapped in one of the worst natural disasters in American history, the Dust Bowl.
Welcome to Natural Disasters, a Parcast original. I'm your host, Kate.
And I'm Bill. Every Monday, we'll explore moments in history when the natural world turned deadly. You can find all episodes of Natural Disasters and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Natural Disasters for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Natural Disasters in the search bar.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help.
This is our second and final episode on the Dust Bowl, an 8-year period of intense drought in the Great Plains of America during the 1930s. Last week, we heard about the onset of the terrible drought and the over-farming of the region that left farmers defenseless against nature.
This week, we'll hear the true stories of farming families trying to survive the worst years of the drought and the terrible dust storms that laid waste to whole towns and took dozens of lives.
We'll also hear about the attempts to heal and protect the land against new threats of drought and explore how the Dust Bowl changed farming in America forever.
The dust storms began in 1932 after a year of drought in the Great Plains. Enormous walls of dark, swirling dirt came rolling over the flat farmland, often lasting for hours or even days.
The storms consisted of fine black powder blasting through the air hundreds of feet high. Residents called them black blizzards.
1934 set a record as the worst drought year in centuries. Temperatures were over 100 degrees Fahrenheit for weeks. Freshly planted crops were literally baked on their stalks and crumbled or collapsed.
As the moisture disappeared from the land, the topsoil dried into black granules. Excess plowing and grazing had removed the natural prairie grasses, so there was nothing to prevent the strong winds from sweeping up hundreds of tons of the dust.
The worst black blizzard of the entire era struck on April 14, 1935. In fact, the day became known as Black Sunday, and the aftermath of this storm would give the Dust Bowl its name.
That morning was sunny and bright. The air was already dry and uncomfortably hot by the time Pauline Gray finished her chores on her family's farm in Meade County, Kansas.
It was just after noon when Pauline looked over the horizon and saw a bluish haze, like a wall of smoke. She yelled a warning to her family.
As quickly as they could, the family rushed inside to stuff rags into the cracks around the doors and windows. The temperature inside the sealed house quickly became unbearable, but they had to stay inside. The storm would be upon them soon.
The mercury thermometer hanging outside registered a drop of 30 degrees as the light disappeared behind the dark, billowing clouds. The storm was approaching with a flurry of howling wind and dust, growing louder as the family huddled together in terror.
Outside, huge flocks of birds flew overhead, trying to outrun the enormous cloud of dust. Only the strongest would survive.
The smallest birds vanished into the storm and were buffeted by the winds until they slammed into the ground and died. Even large birds fell out of the sky from exhaustion.
Jackrabbits scurried across the blowing fields, seeking holes for shelter. But their burrows were impossible to find. The storm had packed them with dust. The rabbits eventually slowed and toppled over as the dirt-filled air suffocated their tiny lungs.
The wind shook the wooden walls around Pauline and her family. They held handkerchiefs against their faces, struggling to breathe as the dust pulsed through the rags stuffed around the windows. The air outside was murky and dark.
Pauline wrote later, "It had the appearance of a mammoth waterfall in reverse. The apex of the cloud was plumed and curling, seething and tumbling over itself from north to south."
The storm hovered for another 3 hours, blotting out the sun. Winds were blowing at 40 miles per hour. Finally, around 4 p.m., the storm moved on, rolling over the plains towards Oklahoma and Texas.
The rolling wall of dust was hundreds of miles wide and reached thousands of feet into the air. Some small towns in the Oklahoma Panhandle were entirely enveloped in the cloud. Drivers stopped and took refuge in their cars while residents hid in their basements and under their beds.
Just before 5 p.m., Ed and Ada Phillips were on their way home to Boise City, Oklahoma. They were driving on the highway with their 6-year-old daughter in the front seat between them when the storm caught up with their car.
The black dust reduced visibility to only a few feet. The headlights could hardly penetrate into the storm. If they kept driving, they risked a head-on collision in the dark.
Ed turned off the highway as soon as he could, following a smaller dirt road until it disappeared. Then, through the blowing storm, they saw a seemingly abandoned adobe hut.
They bundled up their daughter and ran, pushing open the door and searching the dark interior for refuge.
They found 10 other people inside, also hiding from the choking dust. The Phillipses quickly closed the door behind them and joined the others on the floor to wait out the storm. 4 hours passed before they could go back outside.
The storm continued rolling over the panhandles of Oklahoma and Texas, covering the sunset as night fell. Soon, people wouldn't be able to see the dust storm coming for them.
Farmers caught in their fields hurried toward their barns, storm cellars, and outhouses. One man stayed out too long in the blowing dust, working to secure his machines. The dirt particles blasted into his eyes and scratched the corneas. He went blind.
A little after 7 p.m., the storm was over Amarillo, Texas. The wind speed peaked at over 60 miles per hour, tearing the paint off of houses. The storm resembled a giant wave of dirt rolling over the country. By this time, 300,000 tons of dirt were swirling in the grasp of the black blizzard.
Some fields lost a foot of topsoil, while others were buried under dirt that blew in from another state. Water wells were clogged, and whole tractors disappeared under mounds of dust.
The drifting piles of earth grew so high that they blocked railroad tracks and halted locomotives. Airplanes were grounded and tied down as the blasting sand pitted their aluminum skin.
Raymond L. Sasser, a Kansas cattleman, was waiting for his wife and daughter to return home. They had been out driving when the storm hit.
He felt some relief when his daughter arrived suddenly at the front door. She told him the car died less than a mile from the house. Raymond's wife was still out there in the howling storm.
Raymond rushed to his truck and fired it up, turning on the headlamps and carefully driving toward the main road. He could hardly see anything through the swirling dirt. If he went too fast, he might hit his wife before he could see her up ahead.
For several agonizing minutes, Raymond drove back and forth down the road. Finally, his wife spotted the headlights and followed the truck back home. The El Sasser family narrowly avoided a tragedy that day. A few weeks before Black Sunday, the dust from another storm reached the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Congress was in session and, ironically, had been debating a bill about soil conservation in the Great Plains for almost a month.
The congressman from Kansas had to explain the phenomenon to his counterparts from eastern states. He recalled how Hugh Bennett, one of President Roosevelt's advisors and a proponent of soil conservation, had pointed out the window and said, "This, gentlemen, is what I've been talking about."
2 weeks after Black Sunday, Congress would finally declare that soil erosion was a national crisis and establish the Soil Conservation Act. It would eventually enact programs to retain topsoil and prevent further and irreparable damage to the Great Plains.
But that didn't help farmers who were already suffering. The Black Sunday dust storm left hundreds of people dead and huge plots of land covered in drifting piles of dust a foot deep. For many farmers, there was no way to recover their land or buried machines. Many families simply gave up and abandoned their farms.
An Associated Press journalist named Robert Geiger came from Denver to report on the aftermath of Black Sunday. He wrote in the Washington Evening Star that three little words rule life in the Dust Bowl of the continent: if it rains.
The Dust Bowl had finally earned its name. This new moniker stuck as the report was repeated in newspapers and over the radio waves. Eventually, the Federal Soil Conservation Service even used the name on their official maps of the region.
Woody Guthrie, the famous folk singer, lived through the Black Sunday storm in Gray County, Texas. He sang of people fearing for their lives, and the song became known as "So Long, It's Been Good to Know Ya."
The Black Sunday storm was one of the last of the season in 1935, and by far the most destructive. But it was hardly unique.
Dust storms were now a fact of life. Adjustments had to be made. People ate more canned food because it was sealed from the elements until opened.
But even this wasn't completely safe. Within a minute or two of opening a can, the dust would permeate whatever was inside. The tables and plates and floor were covered in dust by the time anyone could finish eating.
Almost every farmhouse relied on a deep well for water. During a dust storm, somebody would have to brave the storm to retrieve a bucket of water from the well. By the time they got back to the farmhouse, the top of the bucket would have a thin layer of mud over it.
People also became used to wearing damp cloths over their faces to block out the dust in the air. But the cloth would absorb so much dirt that it had to be washed several times a day. No matter how much they washed, people would still get sick from breathing in damp dust over and over.
In 1937, a doctor from Guymon, Oklahoma, named John H. Blue, delivered a report to the Southern Medical Association. The report detailed 56 medical cases diagnosed as dust pneumonia.
He noted that the symptoms he found in his patients were only found in mining towns. Tiny particles called silica would enter patients' lungs and scratch the sensitive tissue, leaving scars. There was no cure, and many patients eventually contracted tuberculosis.
Another doctor near Johnson, Kansas, wrote that he had encountered 367 patients whose airways were partially blocked with packed dirt. Several of them coughed up compacted chunks of soil 2 or 3 inches long and as thick as a pencil.
4 Kansas hospitals reported 233 cases of respiratory illness in 1935. 33 of those patients died. By April, over 50% of all patients in the hospital were suffering from the effects of breathing in dust.
But the dust storms weren't the only menace to strike the Great Plains during this period. The region was dealing with the invasion of 2 new pests, jackrabbits and grasshoppers.
As the land dried out, jackrabbits abandoned their burrows and multiplied across the fields, searching for crop sprouts to eat. This meant that even if farmers were able to get some of their fields to grow, the jackrabbits would destroy the crop.
Dust Bowl residents organized jackrabbit drives, where dozens of people would form a line to drive the rabbits into enormous pens. Sometimes 5,000 or 6,000 rabbits were caught in a single drive.
The largest drive was in Dighton, Kansas. Almost 35,000 rabbits were captured. With a shortage of edible crops, the rabbits were a welcome supply of meat. But they were only part of the plague that had descended on the Dust Bowl.
In 1937, over 14 million grasshoppers swept through the Great Plains. The grasshoppers thrived in dry heat, since the natural diseases that checked their population only survived in water. The hoppers ate the small sprouts of crops and plagued farmers as they worked in the fields.
The infestation was so widespread that the grasshoppers could stop a train. Their bodies were crushed beneath the wheels, creating a gooey grasshopper paste. The train wheels would spin in place as if stuck in mud.
They even chewed on the wooden handles of farm tools and the cotton shirts on farmers' backs. A Nebraskan farmer named Elroy Hoffman said that working on a tractor they'd be moving, it would just be like a cloud. And once in a while, a grasshopper would hit you in the face, and that would just knock you cuckoo. But the windy, dry season was almost over. In May, the winds died down. The farmers clung to the hope that rain might return this year.
Finally, on the 25th of May, 1935, rain clouds appeared over eastern Kansas. Only 5 inches fell, but it was enough to keep the soil down on the ground instead of blowing in the wind.
The rain had finally arrived, providing an immense relief to the Dust Bowl. But the rains would only bring more tragedy. Next, we'll hear about the deluge that destroyed all hope.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now, back to the story.
By the summer of 1935, dust storms were common news in the United States. The stories coming out of the Dust Bowl region filled newspapers in the cities and on the coasts, and soon people became desensitized to the plight of the farmers.
But the strange stories were endless for anyone living on the plains. Outside Amarillo, Texas, farmers found a crow's nest made entirely of barbed wire. There was nothing else for the birds to use in the dusty wasteland.
In Dodge City, Kansas, a farmer and his wife lost their oldest child to dust pneumonia, and on the day of the funeral, another dust storm rolled in. A few days later, they found their other baby dead in its crib, its lungs filled with dirt.
Con men took money from farmers after convincing them they could make it rain. These so-called rainmakers used many different techniques, including firing rockets into the air or killing snakes and draping them on fences. Nothing worked.
Meanwhile, the dust storms spread across the country. Dirt from western states like Wyoming and Montana was falling from the sky over Boston and Washington, D.C.
Inhabitants of eastern states could tell where the dust storm had originated by the color of the dirt that fell. Black soil came from Kansas, red from Oklahoma, and gray granite dust came from Colorado.
Ships that were over 300 miles off the eastern coast reported dust falling on their decks. Soil experts estimated that almost a billion tons of dirt had been blown off of the Great Plains by 1935.
So when rain did finally fall, there was very little topsoil to absorb it. This meant the rainwater settled on top of the ground, causing flash floods.
A few inches of rain became a rushing swirl of water that ran down ditches in the Republican River Valley of western Nebraska. Small creeks and rivers burst their banks and spewed muddy water over the wide, flat farmlands.
Wooden bridges were completely washed away by the force of the moving water. Farmhouses were toppled over, and entire families lost their possessions. Thousands of cattle were drowned. The damage and property loss was tallied in the millions.
147 people were drowned in floods in Kansas and Nebraska. In one small Kansas town called St. Francis, 13 flood victims were laid out along Main Street before they were buried.
But the rains brought hope to the farmers who had lost everything.
Lawrence Svobody was a wheat farmer who lived in Meade County, Kansas. He had moved onto his land in 1929 and produced three good harvests of wheat before the drought.
The last of those three, the 1931 harvest, contributed to the surplus of wheat in the nation that year. The price of wheat plummeted when so many farms produced better than average harvests.
Svobody could have never guessed that in the coming years, he would have the exact opposite problem. He continued planting and plowing. As the drought worsened through 1934, he kept a journal of his lost crops and efforts to keep his land alive.
By 1935, Svobody was one of only five farmers left in the entire county. He lost his wheat crop every year, and going into 1936, he knew he couldn't survive another year without a harvest.
So Lawrence planted his wheat at the end of 1935 and waited for spring. In March of 1936, a little snow had fallen and provided moisture for his thirsty crops. The sun began to shine more brightly, casting its warm glow over his fields.
Lawrence began to have hope again. He wrote, "With warmer weather, the wheat was beginning to grow, and the thermometer of my hopes began to climb steadily upward.
Then, on March 24th, all his hopes were dashed. Around 2 a.m., a strong wind rose out of New Mexico and blew across Kansas with wind gusts of over 50 miles an hour. Lawrence listened to the howling from his bed.
The next morning, the wind continued tearing through his fields, and Lawrence didn't dare go outside. The wind blew for over 20 hours before it finally died down around 10 p.m.
The next morning, Lawrence emerged and discovered a wasteland. His fields were completely bare. The wind had wiped them clean of wheat and soil. Several huge steel grain bins had been torn from their moorings and crushed.
Lawrence thought about those neighbors who had already left the county and headed west, abandoning their farms. He considered packing up his few possessions and following them out of the Dust Bowl.
Then, in the farthest western parcel of his land, Lawrence found that a few dozen acres of wheat had survived. He had enough seed to plant for one more season. Hope was not lost yet.
But for many other farmers, hope had dried up years before. 2.5 million people left their farms between 1933 and 1938. Many simply moved to larger towns and cities to look for work, but over 300,000 of them headed to California, hoping to farm new land. It was the largest single mass exodus in American history.
In California, an adult picking grapes could earn $4 a week, about $76 today. Children worked in the vineyards too, though they were paid much less. The job lasted 16 hours a day, often 7 days a week.
But the Dust Bowl families were desperate. Any kind of work would be better than starving to death in the dry plains.
Midwestern towns that had sprung up before the drought when farming was lucrative were now empty. Some lost over 70% of their population in just 18 months.
Out in Oregon and Washington State, where more manual labor jobs were available, 60% of new arrivals were migrants from the Dust Bowl.
The Roosevelt administration even built camps to house the displaced families. These camps were nothing more than tents erected on wooden foundations, but they filled quickly. To keep their place in the camp, migrants had to join work projects.
But there were so many families, the federal camps couldn't house and feed them all. People began to build shanty towns on the outskirts of cities. These self-governing communities were called Okievilles, or Little Oklahomas.
There was no plumbing or electricity in these Okievilles. Many didn't have any fresh water sources. Diseases began to spread in the camps, and there were outbreaks of typhoid, malaria, and tuberculosis.
Many inhabitants of the cities hated the unsightly camps growing outside their community. Vigilantes came and beat people in the shanty towns, calling them names and insulting them.
In February of 1936, the police chief of Los Angeles, James E. Davis, sent out 125 police officers to patrol the borders. He said the goal was to keep undesirables out. A lawsuit was brought against the city by the American Civil Liberties Union, and an investigation into corruption finally stopped the patrols.
But no matter how terrible the conditions were out west, people still believed it was better than the Dust Bowl. More families fled the hot winds of the plains as the summer heat grew unbearable. The summer of 1936 was one of the hottest in history. Temperatures soared over 100 degrees. In North Dakota, one July day reached 121 degrees Fahrenheit. This dried out the land even more as the sun baked the earth.
Farmer Lawrence Svobody described hot blasts of wind that, quote, caused his face to blister so that the skin peeled off.
He had decided to let his fields lie fallow for the summer. This meant he was not planting or harvesting anything in order to hopefully replenish the little topsoil that remained.
Lawrence planted another crop at the end of the year, and in 1937, He was rewarded with a modest harvest of 6,000 bushels of wheat. This allowed him to break even on his costs for the year and eke out another season of planting.
While Lawrence was a rare example in his Kansas county, he wasn't the only farmer who stuck it out after the Great Migration of the previous year. 70% of Dust Bowl farmers stayed on their land and kept planting, even as the harvests vanished.
Residents from Nebraska to the Dakotas were hanging on, hoping that the drought would break in 1938. They had suffered through 6 years of greatly diminished rainfall and vicious dust storms.
But they were reaching the limits of their endurance. The farmers who had already left, as well as meteorologists and land speculators, were saying that the Great Plains would never recover. They called it the Great American Desert.
Lawrence had just enough money and seeds for one more season. On the 3rd of September, 1938, a brief rainstorm wet the soil enough to start seeding.
He finished planting his fields 2 weeks later on September 20th. Then he waited, hoping for rainfall. A half inch fell in October, but none came for the rest of the year.
Finally, in January, there was a rainstorm. The crops sprouted and started to grow. There were 2 days of rain in March and one in April, but the winds came too.
There was not enough moisture in the earth from the scant rainfall to keep the dirt and crops from blowing away. And then, after April, there was no more rain.
Lawrence lost nearly all of his wheat crop. There would be no harvest.
His financial and physical resources were exhausted. In the summer of 1939, Lawrence finally wrote, "I am at last ready to admit defeat and leave the Dust Bowl forever."
The farmers that were left would need the help of the federal government to push back against nature's dusty invasion and make the soil fertile again.
Next, we'll hear about the last-ditch efforts to save the Great Plains from becoming a permanent desert. Now, back to the story.
In the first 2 decades of the 20th century, homesteaders and farmers had moved into the Great Plains with the hope of taming the land. But they didn't have the experience or knowledge to protect the very soil that their livelihood depended on.
By the 1930s, nature had shown them that the consequences of their ignorance were deadly. If the Great Plains were to be saved from a vicious cycle of desertification, then the farmers would have to change their ways.
At the end of the decade, the worst of the drought had passed, but the damage was done. The plains were no longer the fertile breadbasket of the nation. They were a dry, dusty wasteland.
But as the decade that would be called the Dirty 30s dragged on, more efforts were made to curtail the terrible dust storms and loss of crops. Even with rain and mindful soil conservation, it would take years to recover.
Beginning with the election of President Roosevelt in 1932, the United States government began a series of programs to bring America out of the Great Depression.
Many of these federal programs focused on repairing the damage caused by over-farming and drought in the Dust Bowl. The first and most direct program was called the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, or the AAA.
The AAA sought to curb overproduction of crops during times when prices were incredibly low. The AAA paid farmers to leave a percentage of their land unplanted.
This caused much consternation among the working farmers of the Midwest. The dust storms destroyed what few crops were able to grow, and now the government was telling them to grow even fewer crops on purpose.
But the economic advisors in Washington were not concerned about the storms or the heat or even the seemingly endless drought. They were worried about the economy of the entire country, not just the Great Plains.
The AAA payments were meant to stabilize market prices. But to do that, farmers had to destroy millions of acres of crops that were already planted and growing. 6 million pigs were slaughtered to keep the meat from oversaturating the market.
Most of these crops and meat went to waste, and the public outcry was immediate. People across the country didn't have enough food, and the government was killing pigs and wasting crops.
The AAA programs were declared unconstitutional, and the federal payments to farmers stopped. The program hadn't worked, and farms and banks were still failing across the region.
Eventually, the federal government began buying land directly to allow the regrowth of prairie grasses and cut back on the overexpansion of farming.
Depending on the state, farmers could receive up to $4 per acre of farmland. As these acres were left to regrow naturally, the root systems of the prairie grasses and weeds kept the wind from sucking up the topsoil.
Then came the most grandiose idea of them all, the Shelter Belt Project. In 1937, the president enlisted the Works Progress Administration to plant a swath of trees 100 miles wide all the way from the Canadian border to northern Texas.
The intention was that the trees would act as a windbreak and keep the soil locked around the roots of millions of trees stretching across the Great Plains. It was estimated that the project would take 12 years and $75 million to complete.
That was a problem. Since it was considered a long-term strategy, the emergency relief funds were not available. The program was scrapped after only a fraction of the trees were planted.
Not all government programs were focused on the land itself. One of the projects was to document life in the Dust Bowl via photography and films.
The Farm Security Administration commissioned photographers to travel the Midwestern plains and take pictures of the state of farms and families. These photos were not stylized, but rather candid images of life in the region.
Some of these artists, like Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, and Gordon Parks, became famous household names. Their images are still found in museums and history books and are considered some of the most evocative pictures in American history.
The Roosevelt administration's policy was to develop as many programs to alleviate the terrible economic condition of the country as possible. If an idea didn't work, they would focus on a different one.
While the government tried to tackle the problem of blowing dust with large-scale prevention techniques, the Dust Bowl farmers tried new methods on their own farms.
With the expertise of soil conservation research, farmers learned that plowing their fields in furrows or alternating trenches of high and low soil rows prevented the wind from sweeping the fields clean of soil.
The furrows broke the wind speed and protected the soil in the trenches. New machinery was developed to plow furrows quickly and efficiently. One machine even automatically closed the ends of the trenches to trap what little rain fell on the fields and prevent runoff.
As the seasons passed, all of the efforts began to pay off. The furrowed fields, the shelter belt trees, and the acres that were allowed to return to their natural state began to reduce the erosion of soil.
By the end of 1938, 65% less soil was swallowed up by the blowing winds than any year before. The Dust Bowl era was reaching its conclusion.
In the fall of 1939, rainfall returned to normal in the Great Plains. Crops were able to grow healthy and strong. For many farmers, the next year's harvest would be their first in over 5 years.
Melt White, a farmer's son in Dalhart, Texas, remembered the return of rainstorms. He said, "The rain was so welcome, and they smelt so good, I'd lay and listen to them pitter-patter on the side of the old house at night, and we'd really sleep, 'cause it was a wonderful feeling."
A young Kansas farmer named Floyd Cohen said, "When the rain came, it meant life itself. It meant a future. It meant that there would be something better ahead. You'd go out in that rain and just feel that rain hit your face. It was a very emotional time when you'd get rain because it meant so much to you."
But not everyone believed the rains meant recovery. Lawrence Svobody began to write a memoir that year. His years farming the Dust Bowl led him to believe the plains would remain a desert.
He eventually retired in Arkansas, and just before his death, he wrote of the greenery of the retirement home, saying, "I would not trade this, timber, grass, and cattle, and mild winters for all the land in the high plains."
New irrigation techniques were developed through the 1940s and 50s based on the knowledge gained during the Dust Bowl era. The most prominent is called center pivot irrigation, which is one of the primary methods of watering crops used today.
Center point irrigation allows a long line of automatic sprinklers on wheels to rotate around a central water source. The result is a circular watering of crops that conserves the water supply and doesn't require enormous labor.
We can see the results of this technique in the modern day when flying over farmland. The fields with center point irrigation look like giant green circles spread out like a quilt over the plains.
Meteorologists and climate scientists also study the drought of the Dirty 30s to help understand weather patterns in the plains. The information about rainfall patterns and topsoil levels would help them anticipate droughts in the years to come and give farmers time to prepare for farming with less water.
Scientists learned that droughts occur on a cycle in the Dust Bowl region. About every 30 years, there is a period of time when there is less rain, usually lasting 2 or 3 years. Sometimes there is no rain for entire seasons.
With this knowledge, farmers can anticipate the worst and prepare their fields and supplies to survive another long drought.
One of the greatest legacies of the Dust Bowl era was a new focus on conservation. The government programs and funding that were established during that decade became the foundation for modern farm subsidies.
A byproduct of this focus was the protection of aquifers and natural resources. While economics inspires farmers to continue planting new fields, the consequences of overexpansion in the 30s showed farmers that protecting natural vegetation and water sources was just as important as a good harvest.
The terrible lessons of the Dust Bowl taught them that one required the other. If farmers drained the underground water sources and removed the natural windbreaks of the prairies, the dust would return.
The government, under President Roosevelt, provided the funding for farmers to change their practices, and the enduring effort of farmers eventually brought the land back to fertility and allowed the government to provide funds elsewhere. These combined goals kept the Great Plains from becoming a desert.
As a new decade began in 1940, the agricultural economy was slowly rebuilding, and America was coming out of the Great Depression. Unfortunately, it was not only because of American ingenuity or even the hard work of farmers.
The American economy kicked into overdrive after a vicious attack on December 7, 1941. After high wheat prices during the First World War led to overfarming, America was going to war again.
The farmers quickly redoubled their efforts to supply the war economy. The devastation of the Dust Bowl was forgotten as the Great Plains bloomed with wheat and corn.
But the cycle of drought was unaffected by war or any human activities. The rains came and went on the whim of nature, and a severe drought in the 1980s reminded many farmers of the Dust Bowl. Though the economic impacts were severe, only 50% of the corn crop was lost. Farming techniques from the Dust Bowl helped to prevent an even worse disaster. The people living in the Great Plains today know that the threat of drought and blowing dust is always on the horizon.
Thanks for listening to Natural Disasters. For more information on the Dust Bowl, we found Empire of Dust by Lawrence Svobody extremely helpful to our research.
We'll be back next week with a new episode. You can find all episodes of Natural Disasters and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Natural Disasters, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Natural Disasters on Spotify, just open the app and type Natural Disasters in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Natural Disasters was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Brian Golub, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Joel Stein, Maggie Admire, and Travis Clark. This episode of Natural Disasters was written by Andrew Messer and stars Kate Leonard and Bill Thomas.